Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics said they've put out their numbers. Unemployment rates were significantly lower in September in seven states, higher in one state, stable in 42 others, including the District of Columbia. Six states had notable jobless rate decreases. Four states had increases, and 40 states stayed the same. The national unemployment rate remains at 5%. In September, 35 states and the District of Columbia added jobs to the non-farm payroll. Wyoming, the only state to lose jobs, while 14 basically stayed unchanged. Now, you listen to the debate on Wednesday night and really the three debacles, and you would think from the Trump side that the sky is falling. It's the end of the world, that everyone's poor and miserable and all of that. And the other side, you know, saying, look, there's a lot of work to do. But the question becomes, what jobs are coming back? What jobs do we need? Can Donald Trump bring those manufacturing jobs back or not? Here to talk a little bit about that, and also asking the question if the U.S. is really in a boom of manufacturing, our good friend Mateus Fernango, professor of economics at Bucknell University, also fantastic blogger on nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yeah.
So, did you watch the big debate on Wednesday night?
I did, yeah.
Anything
painful,
there that gives you hope?
Well, you know, we talked last week about that. I'm not particularly hopeful. I think there is one positive side. I don't think that there are many chances of Trump winning. I don't think Trump would bring manufacturing jobs back. Certainly, there's nothing in his strategy, cutting taxes for the wealthy, and deregulation that would guarantee that. Yes, you may say perhaps the anti-trade deals, sort of part of his rhetoric, may sort of sound comforting, but I would be surprised if he actually went through with that, given that his party is the one giving support to TPP.
Right.
So it's not guaranteed that would happen. On the other hand, as we said last time, Hillary, although she's clearly against TPP now, may not be completely close to the idea of bringing up some of those trade deals again, and so I think that progressives will have to fight for the right kinds of policies. They're not going to be given to us by politicians for free, and so it's not very hopeful in that respect. I don't think we can get manufacturing jobs out of the blue. And there have been long trends, so as you were saying. So there has been a recent sort of a paper on this old sort of question. You know, the manufacturing employment in the U.S. has stagnated for a very long while, and then at about 2001, so it remained at about 17 million jobs for the longest of periods, from
right.
The late 70s to the early 2000s, and then it took a brutal tumble. And the timing of that, I should say, is there might be more than one explanation, but certainly the timing of that is the entry of China in WTO. It's about that's the timing what happens.
And you could argue permanent normal trade relations did that. And but here's the thing: you look at the rise of Donald Trump, and it's those angry manufacturing people who lost their jobs who are the ones who are driving this kind of outrage. And you look at the number of jobs, and as you pointed out, we held steady at about 17 million. In fact, at the peak, as it was pointed out in 1979, we were close to 20 million manufacturing jobs. To where this September it was down to just over 12 million.
Yeah. Well, what people would argue, and that's part of this article that I was getting from Upjohn Institute, or based on, I'm actually, it suggests that, things are not so bad because manufacturing output, you know, the value added of the manufacturing sector has been increasing. And you know, one shouldn't exaggerate. We're still below the peak of 2007, but, you know, it's still increasing. It's significantly larger than it was in 1979. So what that means is, you know, one way of looking at it is that productivity went up significantly.
Right.
So we need less workers to produce significantly larger amounts of manufacturing output.
Right. So we're making more stuff and it's costing less. So my question always becomes, if that's the case, if you know we're making a whole bunch of stuff and it's not costing, who gets those gains? Because it's certainly not the angry Trump voters, and it's not the people who in the working class who lost their jobs.
Exactly. So there is a question of distribution. There is also the devil is in the details in this stuff. So one of the things that has allowed for this significant increase in productivity, about half of that is computers and electronic sector. And a good chunk of that is hedonic adjustment. So it's the adjustment for quality. So it's that the price of the production of these things has significantly declined over time. And you know, there are arguments there to suggest that that might be an exaggeration, or that that we count, you know, so to speak, the advantages of having access to, say, the internet and smartphones and this, that, and the other, but that we don't account for the costs of what sometimes comes with modern life and having all of these things. So yes, we have phones, but you know, we live further apart from family and have to use it way more and end up spending more money on those and so on and so forth. So even that part, the idea that productivity has gone up, one has to take with a grain of salt, and it's not absolutely clear that necessarily has happened. And then is the part that you're saying, the distribution of those gains have been absolutely sort of uneven, and so the losses are significant exactly for those, you know, blue-collar workers that, you know, have lost on the trade deals. And there is no policies that actually have compensated them for those losses. And that's why you have a lot of these angry people that are considering voting for Trump. You know, you'll have certainly, you know, a significant large part of the population voting for him.
Right. Well, I mean, these are the people who I argue, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, where manufacturing was huge when I was a kid growing up. And I watched right before my eyes a lot of the steel mills go away, a lot of the manufacturing that surrounded the auto plants. I watched a lot of that leave. And you saw those people who lost their jobs, not just lose a job, but lose their identity, lose that sense of self and that self-worth. And I got to be honest, that is much worse than just losing a paycheck.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no. And also, you know, if you have to think in terms of where are we going? So even when you just think, so forget employment share. When you think, because the positive argument is that manufacturing has been growing, but manufacturing too has been growing way less than the economy, than GDP. So the share of manufacturing fell in output, fell from whatever, 25% probably? I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I would say something like that, probably in the 60s to something more like 12% these days. So even in value added, it has taken a significant shot. And the question to think about that is that most technological progress, so the stuff that keeps society moving ahead, comes from the manufacturing sector. So the danger of not doing, you know, so there is always this question, why manufacturing matters? So why would you care? So one reason is, as you said, there is a, you know, sense of self-worth, sense of identity of who you are, what you're doing, and so on and so forth. But as a society, it matters too, because societies thrive because of productivity growth, technological change, the ability to come up with new ways of doing things better.
Yep.
And that tends to happen in the manufacturing sector, you see. I always say, people say, oh, no, we live in service societies in which, you know, all of this stuff, you know, and progress is in services. The problem is that we don't measure that very well in services. But it's not true, you know. Think of the advances in medicine. Most of those come from the pharmaceutical industry. A lot of that, by the way, subsidized by the government. And from, you know, advances in exactly in computers and technology that allows us to make better diagnosis and so on and so forth. And all of those come actually from the manufacturing sector. So it's not like the doctors all of a sudden are much better dealing with the patient's problems. By the way, probably they're in a sense worse off because they are overworked. They have tons of patients that now they can see more because they have technology and other this stuff that But it's not like the family doctor of another era that
who actually knew your name,
deeper knowledge of the patient.
Yep, who actually knew your name.
In a sense,
you're right.
Exactly. So the point is that the service is probably worse. It's compensated because they have access, so they don't need to know you or your family history. Your family history is in the computer. And so the service got slightly better in that sense, but in another sense, it got worse. We're very good at checking and saying, oh, you see, all of this stuff got better because of this, but we don't check the other stuff that got worse. And so a more balanced view would suggest that we do need manufacturing. We do need to keep, because the only way to do things better is if you're doing them. It's the point. So
absolutely.
Some kids in class once time, they asked, so why do we need to produce cars? Well, because if you don't produce cars, you're not going to produce the driverless car or the electrical car or the zero emissions car or whatever. We learn to do things better by doing things.
Yep. And what I argue, Mateus, is that when you lose your manufacturing, you when you lose that base, you lose those tinkerers who go in their garage and try and figure out how to do something better or how to use another machine for another application. And one of my friends, a former congressman from Illinois, said one of his best friends worked in the clothing factory with him and figured out, years and years ago, how to use a sewing machine to put those chips into computer chips into stuff. And did it in a way, made himself a whole boatload of money, but did it in a way that again, back to what you're saying, productivity gains just went through the roof because he figured out how to use this machine that was used for something else in a better way to do something better that helped across the board.
Exactly. But you pointed out something very important. It's the tinkerers. So most of the technological but people have these notions of the genius with a brilliant idea, the Thomas Edison, the Bill Gates. Bill Gates didn't have a genius idea, but that's another story. He signed a good contract, but with IBM. But think of the idea of the genius as being the important thing in technological progress. But it's actually the tinkerer. It's several generations of people sort of working on a thing that improve it. Slightly here, then a little bit more, and then all of those things really add up. So that's why it's important to keep thriving manufacturing sector. So I don't see going back to your question at the beginning, I don't see any path in any party at this point in which this is seriously discussed. I would say this: the embrace by Hillary of the plans. Or at least to some extent, of the plans by Bernie Sanders to help with education. I think that's a path in which at least there is compensation for people that have lost all of those jobs, and certainly we can go the high road, so to speak. We get more of the tinkerers and whatnot at the higher end of this, getting more engineers, getting more people into the design of new products and this, that, and the other. But again, there should be also some sort of, besides the helping with that, a stop on the bleeding, so to speak, of the manufacturing sector.
Right.
Because I think that there is a critical point at which if these things are gone, it's very hard to imagine you can remain competitive and remain, at the forefront of technological innovation.
So are you talking about something like a guaranteed minimum income? Because, look, I mean, at some point, productivity gains are going to continue as we do more automation and we do more of that stuff, and you're going to need less and less workers. Who gets all of those productivity gains? At some point, don't we have to talk about how you distribute that in a way that's good for society? Or should it be, the one guy who developed the machine gets everything?
Oh, no, I agree with you. We that's why I said the distribution of this, we're going to have also in services. It's going to make, imagine the driverless car, the sort of wreck that it will do in in the distribution of goods and services in the U.S. You'll have all of the trucks being, you know, self-driven. So you have there a whole category of, you know, how many workers are there that are going to lose their jobs. And you know, in Pittsburgh, apparently Uber, you know, is going to try already the cabs without the drivers and, you know, drivers' cars and so on and so forth. One way to solve this is, as you said, some sort of minimum income, a reverse income tax, stuff that allows people to actually enjoy the benefits of this sort of increases in productivity. And there are many ways that we can do that. It doesn't necessarily have to be just simply a minimum, guaranteed income. It could be, you know, the old-fashioned way, higher minimum wages. But again, there'll be lots of the problem with all of this is that both parties, the money in the political process and the probable gridlock in Congress would imply that a lot of those things are going to be precluded any sort of legislation with possibility of changing those things. It's not very likely,
right?
With the Clinton administration.
Yeah, but this is why I said at the end of the day, no politician's ever going to be perfect. This is why you need to build movements and you need to build power and pressure from the working class of this country, where we need to have some of that unity, some of that class ideal and the class solidarity.
Yeah, well, the question is, how can we bring? I mean, there are lots of divisive issues in American society these days, and the American working class is divided in many ways that makes it very difficult for. It's amazing, as you said, there are many working class people that would vote for Trump because they have a reasonable claim that this. Economy over the last 30 years has not been great for them, and then you have at the same time, because Trump, while he plays that card, he also plays the card of thinly veiled racism and xenophobia, and you'll have that several people will not vote for that, and there are other inequalities that are brutal. Think of talking about movements and the ability of changing the world we live, things like Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. But it's not evident that we can sort of, and to some extent, the issues are all the same. We're talking about societies, a society that has not been able to share prosperity equally. So part of the story of the weakening of the labor class in the U.S., outsourcing trade deals and this, that, and the other, but we cannot forget also the effects of prison incarceration and the disproportion of African Americans and Latinos in prisons and so on and so forth. And so it's very hard to see a coalition. Obama held very, very sort of in a complicated way the coalition that seemed to generate majorities, but it's not very clear that we're going to be able to regain Congress and make significant changes in the way we run the economy.
No, not good stuff. Last question I've got for you. I'm reading through this article that says, and I think you alluded to it a moment ago, that half of the growth in manufacturing is just from the computer and electronics manufacturing sector. Do we still make computers and electronics in this country?
We probably don't make even the components. I know that, for example, computer chips are, besides Asia, even in Latin America and Costa Rica, Intel had factories and whatnot. We don't make the design. Yeah, that's for sure of several of these things. But those, as you said, they go to the people that at the high end of the corporations, the engineers, the top management, particularly the top management of the company that designs those things. So as a model. This is certainly a society for the very few, and that's visible in the data. So that's visible in the data in terms of how wealth and income have become concentrated at the top in the U.S.
Another one of those stories. Mateus, I appreciate you taking a little time for us. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Always great talking with you, our friend Mateus Vernango, professor of economics there at Bucknell. Also, check out the blog, nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mateus's name, take you right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.